Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lincoln on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lincoln on Lending, David Lincoln.
So good to have you with us, everybody. Appreciate you tuning in and being a part of the way more and more people in our industry are getting the news and updates of what's going on in the industry. So we're honored and privileged to have you here. Killed the music so you can hear us a little bit better. But anyway, want to say thank you so much. It is June 6th. How time does fly. We're already in June. I mean, I just struggle to understand how time is moving out at such a warp speed. But it's good to have you be with us. We say the date and of the program at the beginning of it, because many of you are downloading and listening to this program after the fact. So you're listening to the June 6th, 2016 program. Again, this broadcast was created by mortgage professionals for mortgage professionals, and we are the proud recipient of the Progress in Lending Innovation Award. Very happy about that. We appreciate you joining us. Today's hot topic is on senseless regulation. If you're in this industry, you know a little bit about that. And our guest today, Bill Isaac was the former chairman of the FDIC and published a book on this topic of senseless government intervention is really what it is. We're going to be talking more about the book and the proper title at the hot topic segment. I heard Bill speak recently at the American Bankers Association Real Estate Lending Conference. Bill was so compelling. Bill is senior me by a few years, but is out and speaking and staying very active in getting his voice heard, as he has a concern about where the country is heading as it relates to regulation, senseless involvement of the regulation. You know what? I've never forget Ronald Reagan's words. The 9 scariest words in the English language is, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Cracks me up when you read that. It's almost a little bit of what's going on in our It's really going on in our industry. And Bill has got a book on it. We're going to be talking about that book, talking about how it relates to today and what's going on. He's been on the speaking circuit on national television, and it's a real honor to have Bill Isaac here with us. Folks, it is a real honor to welcome to our podcast Bill Isaac. Now, if you go to the website, you can go to his website, and it's williamisaac.com. And I just realized I better turn on his mic so he can join in the discussion here a minute. But Bill's website is, again, williamisaac.com. I encourage you to head out there. As you see right here on there, it's not showing him disrespect by using a name. He uses his first name, Bill, as Billy versus William on his website. So for those who are very formal, say it's William. Well, he goes by Bill, and he is a great individual that I am so thrilled to get to know and listen to. The amount of wisdom this man has, the experiences he has had an unparalleled career in the financial industry and public service spanning 50 years. He's a little bit older than I am, and he's out there, so it's fun to hear him say, "Good to see you, youngster," and that. And so he said, "I'm just a pup," so I'm glad to hear that. And 65, turning 66 in August, it's so nice to hear someone say, "I'm still young in the industry." He served as the chairman of the FDIC during the crisis of 1980. He published a book, Senseless Panic, that has received a lot of attention. If you go to his website, you'll see his TV interviews that he's been on numerous times, the media coverage, and this is not only just a website, but it's a blog post. So he's putting up very important information that he wants you to share. I listened to him speak at the American Bankers Association Real Estate Lending Conference, and he was just as compelling. He held everyone. There wasn't one person that left the room, and it was just really good content, and I'm honored to have him here. So, Mr. Isaac, it's good to have you here, sir.
It's good to be here. I've been enjoying the show.
Oh, good.
I'm actually sitting in Florida right now, and we have some sort of a tropical depression coming through, and so it's very overcast and rainy.
Well, we had it in here, as you know, just a short time ago, and so you get to enjoy what we've been swimming through here. But we got a gorgeous day in Central Texas, but normally it's just a flip-flop. You've got gorgeous weather out there. But I really, you know, talk about cloudy weather. You talk about what you have seen in the financial services over your 50-year career. And the, first of all, let's do get our listeners familiar with Andy Schell. Has been tracking you for decades, and but some of our listeners may not be aware of you. So let's talk. Just give a real brief background of how you, from the time out of college, you have a law degree, you have a background. Let's talk about that and how you got to the point or chairman of the FDIC, quite a prestigious position.
Well, I am from Bryan, Ohio. It's a small town in northwest Ohio. Not too many people probably have heard of it, but probably have some of its products, such as Etch-a-Sketch and Spangler Candy Company with the Dum Dum Suckers. Anyway, that's where I came from. I went to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio for undergraduate, and I went to The Ohio State University for law school. My first position in the real world was with Foland Lardner, a law firm in Milwaukee. It's one of the largest firms in the country today, probably certainly in the top 10 in terms of size in the U.S. today. That was my first position, and that's where I got introduced to banking. I wanted to be a labor lawyer, and they asked me to be a banking lawyer, so I did. And then after being there 5 years, I left, and I went to First Kentucky National Corporation, the largest banking company in Louisville, Kentucky, where I was vice president, general counsel, and secretary. And it was from there that I was appointed to the FDIC board by Jimmy Carter 4 years later. So I was 33 when he appointed me. I was 34 by the time I took office. And I was named to the three-member. It was three members at the time. It's five members now. Three-member FDIC board. It was bipartisan. And so I was appointed to the Republican seat on the FDIC board, and I was named chairman by Ronald Reagan when he was elected in 1981, and I served until the end of 1985. So altogether, I was on the board about 8 years under two different presidents, and the 1980s, as everybody I think knows, was a very, very difficult, turbulent time in the financial world in particular. But we were hit with very severe economic conditions that put what happened in 2008, 2009, to put it in perspective, this was far worse. What happened in the 1980s was far worse and had far more potential to do harm than anything that happened in 2008, 2009. Not very many people realize that today, but these were very, very severe conditions in 2000, in the 1980s, and we almost lost control of the system, but we didn't, and it's very important to know that. So I'll stop there and let you.
You know, that's good. I want to get Andy Schell on here because he lived through some of that with you and some of that. But if you could comment about that crisis, Andy, and then relate to what our most recent crisis, then we're going to get Joe and Alice are going to get you involved here just shortly. But I want to get into that perspective and putting it in perspective from then to the day. Andy?
Well, just real quick, Dave. Thanks for letting me join in. Well, I was in a depository in the Dallas area throughout the 80s. And in Texas specifically, during that time, if you think about Texas as having maybe five major metropolitan areas and another like Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Austin, and then probably another 50 cities that are of some size on the map, it's more than just a little bitty dot. There were 274 depositories off the top of my head that failed during that time frame in Texas. So there were places where there was a gas station, a bank.
By the way, including 9 out of the 10 largest Texas banks failed.
Yeah, that's InterFirst. Yeah, First Republic. Exactly, Bill. So there would be a bank in a corner, a bank, and a gas station. And by the end of the 80s, it was a gas station, gas station, gas station, gas station, because every single bank, every single drive-in branch failed. It was phenomenal. If you drove through downtown Dallas, where there used to be these big, big, tall buildings, 50, 70-story buildings that were bank buildings, by the end there was just the one that was North Carolina National Bank, became Nations Bank, became Bank of America. But it's hard to look back and you know, as I think about it now, it's just, it was unsettling, it was unnerving, it was catastrophic. You didn't know how deep the hole was. Examiners would come in and look at a bank's condition and think it was going to be, you know, X amount of loss, and a year later it was 10 times that. The real estate crash that hit and the impact it had on the industry was just unfathomable, and like Bill said, substantially worse than what we just endured. So, Bill,
it's,
you want to comment on that more?
Well,
yeah, it's hard to imagine
it's worse than that, than what we went through.
I think that...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think that what's important to know is, first of all, that we had a severe inflation problem in the 1970s. And so when Paul Volcker became chairman of the Fed in 1978, with the instructions from Jimmy Carter, we've got to get rid of inflation. It was out of control. We were sort of like a third world country in terms of what was happening with inflation. And so Paul Volcker came in and raised the prime rate from somewhere around 7 or 8% to 21.5%. And that seems unfathomable. Here we've got prime rate at what today, 3 or 2? I mean, it's very, very low. And throughout most of my lifetime, it was somewhere around this 5 or 6% range. Paul Volcker raised the prime interest rate to 21.5%, and it stayed there until we broke the back of inflation. That caused a depression, a literal depression, in the agricultural sector. The bottom dropped out completely in agriculture. We had a collapse of the energy sector, and it's so severe that the FDIC became the largest owner of oil rigs in the world.
Wow.
From taking them over from failed banks that had financed them. And then we had a collapse in the real estate sector. Mm-hmm. And finally, of course, the S&L industry went down with that. The entire S&L industry was basically wiped out. And then on top of all that, our major money center banks, the banks in New York and Chicago and so forth, they were loaded completely to the gills with loans to lesser developed countries. They made a lot of third world loans. And those loans were all at risk. One of our biggest fears, despite all these other challenges, one of our biggest fears was that the third world countries, Brazil, Argentina, and so forth, would renounce their debts, in which case all of our money center banks, we would be forced to nationalize them. They couldn't survive on their own if that happened. And so we had a standby plan in place to nationalize our major banks in the U.S. if need be. That's how severe the problems were. And altogether in the 1980s, we had approximately 3,000 banks and S&Ls fail, including many of the largest in the country. We've mentioned 9 out of the 10 largest banks in Texas. Seattle First, the largest bank in the Northwest. Southeast Bank Corp, the largest bank in the Southeast. Bank of New England, the largest bank in the Northeast. Continental Illinois, the 6th largest bank in the country. All of these major institutions throughout the country failed. And that's what we were facing during that period. It was a far more severe crisis than we were faced with in 2007, 2008, 2009. Far more severe. I'd like to think it was handled a lot better. And that's why I wrote the book, Senseless Panic. It was about how poorly the crisis was handled in 2008, 2009, how we could have done so much better.
Why is it that the current pain is always more than the historical pain? I think we put more credence in it, but it's really interesting to put that in perspective. And it wasn't until you and I were talking that really, and when I heard you speak, that really brought that to the forefront. And so then you look at the mistakes there were mistakes made in the 80s financial crisis, but far less than what were made in this most recent crisis. That's what prompted you to read the book. Bring us forward to that book. There's so much. We could do several programs just on the banking crisis of the 80s and what we all went through. And I was in Seattle. I watched Seattle First fail. I looked at that and what kind of panic. But let's go to why you wrote the book and the premise of that book. And it's a, one of those books that I really encourage our listeners to pick up and read. Senseless Panic. You can get it on Amazon. You can go to the website and order it. But give us the backdrop of that and where that book has taken you and what you're doing now today.
Well, I had moved on with my life following leaving the FDIC. I started my own firm to consult with financial institutions and try to help them deal better with their issues and problems. And I've been doing that since then. And I have commented on the public policy issues over the years, but I was relatively quiet until I watched the crisis in 2008 develop and get out of control. And the government proposed a terrible piece of legislation called TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program. And they proposed to pass that law, and what that law would have done was taken $700 billion of our money and give it to the largest banks in the United States and elsewhere. The money could also go to foreign banks to try to buy from them their troubled assets, the name of the program, Troubled Asset Relief Program. And there was no way that program was going to be anything but a waste of taxpayer money, our money. It was not going to fix the banking system. You can't fix a $15 trillion system by buying $700 billion of bad loans. And then what would you do with them? What would the government do with $700 billion of bad loans other than let them lie in a warehouse floor somewhere collecting dust and losing money? It was not a fix. I argued against it. I wrote a piece that appeared in the Washington Post at the same time Congress was considering TARP. And the title of the article was, "There's a Better Way Than TARP." And so I explained in the article what I thought were better solutions than throwing away $700 billion of taxpayer money. And it was published on a Saturday in September of 2008, and my phone began to ring off the hook with members of Congress calling me saying, "You've got to come to Washington and help us." I rejected it and rejected it, and finally I said to one member of Congress, I'll talk to my wife when she gets home, and I'll see what she says, because I planned a family weekend. So anyway, she came home, and I told her what was going on. She said, "You have to go." I said, "Why?" She said, "Because you care. You care about the country. You care about the banking system. So go and see if you can help fix it." And I did, and I spent a week in Washington and met with hundreds of members of Congress. I couldn't believe the reception I got. It was so good. And the first vote they took on the TARP legislation in the House was defeated. And I was so thrilled that they turned down that terrible legislation. Of course, it did ultimately pass. And it didn't do anything to fix the system. The Dow, when they passed that legislation, the Dow was at 10,800. And over the next few months, after TARP was passed, over the next few months, the Dow fell to a little over 6,000, from almost 11,000 down to about 6,000. So it clearly did not resolve the problems, did not resolve the crisis. We've sort of bumbled our way since then. We haven't fixed it. And that's what caused me to write the book, Senseless Panic. This was a totally senseless panic. The crisis was mishandled. The solution to the crisis was mishandled. And the Dodd-Frank law that was passed following the crisis was mishandled, a terrible law. And our economy and our country have been struggling since. And we've got to find a way out of this. And that's basically how I spend a lot of my time now, trying to talk to people about how we fix what's wrong with our country.
I appreciate your passion, and I appreciate your purpose, and I'm grateful that you are still engaged in the process of trying to get a voice out there. One of the things when we talked previous to the broadcast, you commented about Senator Dodd, and I had the privilege of talking to him, of all places, at the Dulles Airport while waiting in line for our flights. We spent quite a bit of time visiting. And you shed some light on something that was very interesting. I'd like to have you share with our radio audience. What the Dodd part of the Dodd-Frank was originally proposed was actually something that was pretty decent. So if you could, or it was sensible. I don't know if it's decent. How would you characterize it if you shared that story with our audience?
Well, Senator Dodd was really a voice of reason throughout much of this, and I have had a great deal of admiration. He proposed the Dodd bill, and what the Dodd bill would have done, which was exactly what needed to be done. Our regulatory system was broken. It remains broken. It is not a good regulatory system. There have been three major banking crises in my career, the 1972 to 1975. We had a terrible real estate crisis fed by the real estate investment trusts that the banks founded all over the country. And then you had the 1980s. By the way, in that 1970s crisis, virtually every significant bank in the country was on the edge of failing. During the 1980s, of course, I've described what went on then when we had some 3,000 banks and thrifts fail. And then, of course, 2008, 2009. So we've had three major banking crises in this country during my career, my working career. And so it leads you to ask, what's wrong? Why do these things keep happening every 10 years or so? Why do we have one financial crisis after another? And a significant part of it is we are not doing a good job of regulating the banking industry. And so what Dodd proposed was to create a new independent banking agency that would take the place of the Fed and the controller of the currency that are currently regulating banks. He also would have merged the FDIC into that banking commission. It would have been a five-member bipartisan board that would be independent of the Treasury and the Fed, independent of the Congress, and would have given the banking industry and financial industry the kind of regulation it needs. And that was not considered by the Congress, and it was not considered by the Bush administration or the Obama administration. And so finally, Senator Dodd gave up. He was leaving office, and he joined with Representative Barney Frank, who was supporting the administration's bill, the Obama administration's bill, and that was to come up with this Dodd-Frank law, which was basically a useless law and harmful in the sense that it gave people the sense that we changed things when we hadn't. We have not changed a badly broken regulatory system and structure that needs to be fixed. And Senator Dodd decided he was leaving office, so he got on board with the Dodd-Frank legislation. But his law would have been a far better fix to what was wrong in our country than the Dodd-Frank law will ever be.
Alice Alvey reports on this all the time, so I'm going to have Alice jump in, and then I'm going to go over to you, Joe, and we're going to run slightly longer than our normal programming here because this is just so critical, especially the lessons we've learned. Alice, have you jump in with a couple of questions here?
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Bill. I'm just fascinated. I can't take notes quickly enough, you know, because I actually started as a processor in the early 80s, so I do remember that 21.5% interest rate and everybody being happy when they got an ARM at 11%. My question then goes back to what you were just talking about, you know, and how do we fix what's wrong? So we're already here. I think a lot of people would agree with you that this, you know, bill, the Dodd-Frank, ended up being just a lot of regulation to make us all do stuff, but didn't really fundamentally get at the core of the problem. So what are some of the things that we should be doing next?
Well, if I were the president, or if I were advising the president,
Running now? We're looking for somebody.
Yeah, it's a little late for that. but I think that one thing that I would advise the new president to do is to put together new legislation that really makes sense, not 2,500 pages long. By the way, the Dodd-Frank law is 2,500 pages long, and it spawned at least 25,000 pages of new regulations, and it doesn't really fix anything. It's just gobbledygook. It really is. So I think what I would advise the new president is I would come up with a reform law that focuses primarily on regulatory reform so that we get regulation of banking institutions and financial institutions. We get that right. And then and it needs to be independent, as Senator Dodd suggested, needs to be an independent of politics. We need to get that right. And then once regulators are doing their job properly, which they already had all the authority they needed to do everything that should have been done, but they didn't do it. So once we get the regulatory system right, there's not much else that needs to be done. We might need a law here or there to deal with some issue, but we basically need to get the regulatory system right. So if I were advising the new president, I'd say let's revive Senator Dodd's law, and let's put that on the table with perhaps some other reforms here and there, and then let's repeal Dodd-Frank. As that new law passes, we'll repeal the Dodd-Frank law, and let that new regulatory authority start from scratch and do what really needs to be done to get the banking system regulated properly and functioning properly. So that's what I would do. It's pretty simple, really. We need to do what we know how to do. We know how to regulate banks properly. We just haven't done it because we haven't had the political will to do it, and that is partly and importantly a product of not having the proper structure for our regulatory agencies and the proper independence.
Well, I tell you, I think that makes sense. Let's go over to Joe Farr. Joe?
Yeah. Bill, you're describing an independent agency that sounds very similar to what the CFPB is right now. And you know, that's being met with a lot of resistance, given how independent it is. What do you think is going to happen there, and what would you recommend? Would you recommend any changes in that regard?
By the CFPB, you mean the Consumer Financial...
Financial Protection Bureau, yeah.
Protection Bureau. And I am not somebody who is strongly opposed to that agency. I'm not opposed to it at all. I mean, that's heresy among bankers.
Yeah.
I think almost all bankers would tell you they hate that agency. But
why do people hang up on the podcast right now?
Well, stay on the podcast long enough to hear me out, and then you'll make up your mind. But I don't think the problem was creating a new agency to be focused on consumer compliance. That was already going on among the banking agencies, but it was sort of a conflict for them to have, you know, are you supposed to protect the banks and have the banking system working right, or are you supposed to be taking care of consumers? And it was very confusing and difficult for bank regulators to sort that out. And I didn't have a problem with putting that in an independent agency and make it clear what the banking agency should be concerned about. Now, one of the things we did wrong is we kept the banking agencies involved in this while we created a new agency to be involved in it. I think one mistake we made is we should have taken the banking agencies out of consumer compliance and completely, instead of having them do it and the CFPB do it. Secondly, I believe the CFPB is not structured properly. It's headed by a single individual, not a board. I believe it should have been a board of directors of the CFPB. I believe it should have been a bipartisan board, not a single individual appointed by a president from a particular party. I think it should have been a bipartisan board. I think it should have been independent, but it should have gotten its funding from Congress, not from the Federal Reserve. So a lot of things were wrong with the structure of the CFPB and how they went about it, and those are easily fixed. But having the banking agencies focus their attention, or the new banking commission focusing its attention on banking and making sure that's going right, I think that's a good way to go. and having a new CFPB focused on whatever the consumer issues are and have that be their mission, I think that's a good way to go. And I don't have a problem with it. So I think that it could have worked. I think neither one of them is structured properly, and it's all in the structure. If you don't get the structure right, if you don't get the governance right, you're not going to get anything right, and that's where we are.
Boy, I tell you, there's a lot of wisdom there, a lot of experience, and we need to get this voice inside of the next campaign or whoever's going to be in the White House. So, yeah, it's too late for you to run, but we definitely can get your voice inserted in there. We'll have to do that. Got some bunch of ideas that are running through my mind of what we can do to get your wisdom and experience brought to everyone's attention. But I, first of all, what I want everyone to do is go out and download the book Senseless Panic. Read it. Pay attention to it. Forward it on to one of your local legislators that are going to D.C. and that are in D.C. representing you. I think this wisdom needs to be there. Bill is available to talk at conferences, to speak at your company, to come on and get – we need his voice out there for so many reasons that you've already heard here. We're out of time. We're actually beyond out of time. We went over a little bit, but it was well worth it to have you here with us, Bill. I want to say thank you. I also want to say thank you to Alice, Andy, Joe, participating in the discussion here. Appreciate you. Wish you all the best for in the future, and we want to make sure we're going to do what we can to get your voice out there and heard and hopefully sitting at the table for to fix with wisdom in this time, correctly fix the issues that are still before us. Thank you so much for being a part of it, and wish really great having you.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate talking with all of you and your listeners.
Yeah, it's really been a real honor. Next week, folks, we've got Mitch Kiner coming on along with his sons. You heard that old show, Father and Sons? Well, that's what we've got going on. Mitch Kiner and his three boys are going to be coming on and be talking. It's just before Father's Day, so I thought it would be a way to honor or talk about Father's Day, but also talk about leadership, leadership in the home, leadership as fathers, leadership within the industry. His boys have gone on and continue to follow Mitch's legacy and providing wisdom and out there. So we're really honored to have Mitch Kiner joining us next week on the podcast, along with his the Father and Sons, that whole program. I think it was Ed McMurray. We got Andy would know who it was that did that. Ed McMurray, I think it was. Was it not Andy Schell? But anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
It was great.
My three sons, Ed McMurray.
Yeah. I remember that program like yesterday. And so we're going to have Mitch and his sons on next week in advance of Father's Day. Good to have you with us. Appreciate you being a part of the podcast. The most important thing you can do is tell others about the podcast so that people know what we're doing. And this is a way of getting information out. Anyone who comes in and has been a part of this podcast gets hooked on it. They go, it's really helpful, and we appreciate your support. Best way you can support us is tell others about it. Have a great week, everybody. Look forward to having you back where we will talk to Father and Son, Mitch Kiner, and his three sons. We'll talk to you soon. Have a great week, everybody.
This has been Lickin on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U. Come by next week and thank you for listening.